So tonight's Dharma talk, I gave you the title, It All Comes Down to Right View. First of all, I wanted to sort of talk a little bit about what the heck is right view, right? And if you look at the Noble Eightfold Path, the first step on the Noble Eightfold Path is sometimes called right understanding, but it's also sometimes called right view. So this is like, it's really important how you begin. And that's sort of the theme of this talk. And I'm going to look at right view in a variety of ways. But I want to actually read a few things first. This is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. Right view is the important first step on the path because it sets the direction. No matter how long or difficult our journey will be, if we're heading in the right direction and we keep on going, we'll certainly reach the goal. If we don't know the right direction, then even with strong aspiration and efforts, we might wander for a long time and never reach our destination. The Buddha said, that just as the dawn is the forerunner and precursor of the rising sun, so is right view the forerunner and precursor of the breakthrough to the Four Noble Truths. Pretty strong stuff. Huh? Basically what he's saying here is that we have to make sure that what we're doing makes sense, that we're heading in the right direction, that we have right view. There's also this little poem. This is a Ryokan. Ryokan is a 17th century Japanese wandering monk poet. And he wrote these very short, pithy little poems. And this is one I like a lot that talks very directly about this. Buddha is your mind, and the way goes nowhere. Don't look for anything but this. If you point your cart north when you want to go south, how will you arrive? It's talking about the same thing Joseph was talking about. It's like you have to pointing yourself in the right direction. And that's what right view allows us to do. And then one other thing. This is from Ajahn Sumedho, who is a Western monk who founded the original monastery, Theravada Monastery in England. And he's writing about this. He's talks about this in the context of the Fourth Noble Truth. The Fourth Noble Truth is the Eightfold Path. The first of the eight factors on the path is right view, which develops from having seen and experienced cessation. To have right view requires that we be very mindful all the time. We must know that everything arises and passes away and is not self. But this must be a direct experience, an insight. Right view is based on direct, insightful knowing, not just thinking and believing in the concept. As long as we don't really know, but just think you know, you will always be in a state of uncertainty and be confused. This is because intellectual knowing is based on symbols alone, not on direct experience of the truth. So here he's saying something quite interesting, and this points to sort of the cyclical nature of the practice. He's talking about when you really, really have right view. Yeah, but right view starts. We begin right view just at the beginning, just by perhaps just like hearing a Dharma talk like this and going, oh, never thought of it quite that way. know, it's just, it's a, and we start, and then we go, we try and follow the Buddhist teachings as best we can. And at some point we come back around, because it is like a spiral, these teachings and the practice of them. And we go, oh, that's what they meant about right view. And now you sort of get a deeper understanding, until eventually you have what Ajahn Sumedho is talking about here, where you have this insightful knowledge, which is not something you think you know. It's not something you figured out. It's not something you believe on faith because that's what someone said. You know. That's the end of right view. The final form of right view is this knowing. But all the other steps along the way that we go through are equally valid and important. It's like we sort of keep coming back to all of the steps on the Eightfold Path. So we have to start at the very beginning. Without right view at the very beginning, we're not even going to start, right? But our quote right view at the beginning might be something you read or something you heard, and go, yeah, so now let's go on and see onto the right attitude or right intention, which is the second step. We're now, okay, I see that makes sense. Therefore, I have to do something about it. So right intention, right, the second step on the Eightfold Path is based totally on having right view. So our right intention develops over time, just like all the other steps. Every one of the steps on the Eightfold Path, we keep going, seeing things a little more clearly, a little deeper, and then, oh, gee, I never thought of it quite that way. I've said this to myself many times. And we sort of go, oh, okay, yeah, now I see what I was missing last time, and it sort of comes clear, and you have a deeper understanding of it through this, the practice of insight. And that's what insights, what I just described are insights. We start to have insight into the truth of the Buddha's teachings in a way that is not intellectual, that somehow intuitive, intuitional, those are all okay words, but there's no real word to describe what I'm talking about. Okay. So then what I wanted to do was talk about, well, one way to understand right view is what's wrong view? What's the opposite? How do we, if we understand what wrong view might be, then we'd have a better and clearer understanding of right view, right? It's the opposite of all this stuff, right? And there is this quite incredible teaching in the sutta and this is, I'm going to talk about this from in one place in the sutta, but it occurs in many places in the Buddhist teachings, called the 10 unwholesome acts of body, speech, and mind. Sounds kind of grim. In the sutta, by the way, he talks about the unwholesome acts and he talks about the opposites of them. Here's the right view. Here's what the result of right view is, essentially. But it's important that we understand what wrong view is. And so I want to talk about this from that sort of angle. So these are the 10 unwholesome acts of body, speech, and mind. So the first three are unwholesome acts of body. And by the way, there's many places in the Buddha's teachings where he says the real important ones are the mind ones. But we have to sort of get it together at the level of body and speech before we can get it together at the level of mind. It's once again this progressive process. But so the three unwholesome acts of body are killing. In broader sense, harming living beings. That's number one. You know, this is quote, an unwholesome means, doesn't mean bad. It's not a wagging finger here. It means it's not conducive to the mind being still. That's what unwholesome means here. It's like, it's not, by acting in this way through your body, your mind is going to be disturbed. It's not going to go still. You're not going to have clarity of mind. Okay. I want to make that clear too. So the second one, taking what's not offered. Now, this is from the monastic point of view, because remember, these teachings were all given to monastics. This was like, you know, monastics were totally dependent on the people around them to supply all their needs. And they just literally would walk through the village with their bowl, with their eyes downcast, and people would put things in their bowl, and that's what they ate that day. Or the people would come to the Wat on full moon nights and new moon nights, and they'd bring gifts, like bring some cloth to make. So they saw this, you know, the one of the sadhus, one of the bhikkhus, was sort of, his robe was pretty tatty. And they'd bring some cloth so that he could make a better robe. Though the monk, the sadhus, the bhikkhus had to make their own robes. They wouldn't make the robes for them, but they'd bring them the cloth at least and some thread. That sort of thing. But those were all things that were offered. So taking what wasn't offered is like this restraint. So taking what isn't offered, just like going into someone's house and going, oh, this looks pretty good, I'll take some of this food out of the pot and put it in my begging bowl, that would be something unwholesome. Another layer, you might think of this simply as theft. I mean, theft is the ultimate taking what isn't offered, both as a monastic and as householders. You know, where that thing wasn't offered, you just took it. And then this broad area, misconduct in sensual pleasures, which basically means, you know, not being very careful with your sexual energy. I'm not going to go into detail about that. We all understand what that means. But those are the three unwholesome acts of body. And then in the sutta, we come to the next, which, and this is interesting, the next four, so the bulk of these 10 are about speech. Oh, because speech, the Buddha really understand that speech is where which is how we interact with other people, how we interact with other beings, other human beings, is the most problematic area for all people. Just part of being a human being is this is where we get ourselves in trouble more often than any place else. And you know, certainly in the Buddha's time, they're talking more about verbal speech. Now we're talking about writing, you know, slamming someone on the internet, for instance. You know, now you're typing or, you know, those sorts of things. But it's like, that's all speech. And I just want to read this one particular section of the sutta because it's so clear what he's talking about. And now, oh yes, this is the Buddha talking to some some Brahmins. And now there are four kinds of verbal conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma, unrighteous conduct. Here, someone speaks falsehood when summoned to a court or to a meeting or to his relative's presence or to his guild or to the royal family's presence and questioned as a witness thus, so good man, tell what you know. Not knowing, he says, I know, or knowing, he says, I don't know. Not seeing, he says, I see, or seeing, he says, I do not see. And he's not telling the truth, right? In full awareness, he speaks falsehoods for his own ends, for another's ends, or some trifling worldly end. So that's number one. He speaks maliciously. He repeats elsewhere what he has heard here in order to divide those people from these people, or repeats to these people what he's heard elsewhere in order to divide these people from those people. Thus, he is one who divides those who are united. a creator of divisions, who enjoys discord, rejoices in discord, delights in discord, a speaker of words that create discord. Doesn't that sound like what goes on the internet all the time right now? And this could be, you know, this could be a very good description of Tucker Carlson and how he speaks. But not just, I just use Tucker Carlson as a whipping boy because I'm aware of who he is. I'm sure there's thousands of people just like Tucker Carlson out there putting stuff on the web all the time that is just, in fact, I have to put in a little side rant here. I was watching the hearings for Ketanji Jackson Brown for the Supreme Court. And some of the senators, this is exactly what they were doing. They were creating discord. That's what that was their objective. It was pretty sad watching it. It was like, wow. That guy's gone totally over the edge. He was like being really rude. He was interrupting her all the time. He was just like, anyhow, creating discord. He speaks, and so that's number two. He speaks harshly. He utters such words as are rough, hard, hurtful to others, offensive to others, bordering on anger, unconducive to concentration. That sounds interesting. Unconducive to concentration. That means he's stopping people from being able to pay attention by the loud, aggressive nature of his speech or her speech. Just being a jerk, basically. This is mine. In our parlance, that would be a pretty good description of this person, like someone who's just loud and belligerent. Yeah. And then finally, the last one, he says, he's a gossip. He speaks at the wrong time, speaks what is not fact, speaks what is useless, speaks contrary to the Dhamma and the discipline. At the wrong time, he speaks such words as are worthless, unreasonable, immoderate, and unbeneficial. That is how there are four kinds of verbal conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma, unrighteous conduct. So these are the four unwholesome acts of speech. Speaking falsehood, speaking maliciously, and so intentionally causing divisions among people, speaking harshly, being hurtful or offensive to others, and gossip, and then speaking at the wrong time, or just speaking what is useless, just babbling. So those are the four unwholesome acts of speech. Then we come to these aspects of mind. This is getting a little, now we get into more subtle things all the time, right? So the first of the three unwholesome acts of mind is covetousness, wanting something that isn't yours to begin with. Wanting something, you covet something, is like, you know, it's like that one of the commandments, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. That's a reflection of that in a sense, but this is in a much broader sense, of course, where it's just like, I want this, I want this, I want this, I want this, I need this, I gotta have this, which is of course exactly what our culture encourages us to do, right? And we're always supposed to want more things. If we're not out there consuming, if we're not out there coveting, then it's bad for the economy. You know, where the gross domestic product isn't going to grow. Oh no, that's gonna be so terrible. But that's what he's talking about here. Covetous thoughts. And the problem with that is that we get caught up in what, well, how am I gonna get this? And you know, and that sometimes leads, this is what's interesting, sometimes leads to speaking falsehoods or speaking improperly, or even to theft, taking what isn't offered. So this is a progression of issues as well. It's stated as 10 separate things, but they're all interrelated in that sort of way. And then the next one is ill will. And there's this little passage in the Dhammapada I want to read about this. This is verse 50 of the Dhammapada. So the Dhammapada is the sort of the poetic sayings of the Buddha. And it's this beautiful collection of very brief, pithy teachings. This is just one verse from the Dhammapada. Focus not on the rudeness of others, not on what they've done or left undone, but on what you have or haven't done yourself. Isn't that great advice? It's like, don't sort of go on and on about other people's, well, what's wrong with them, they blah, 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 blah. Like I just did with Tucker Carlson, by the way, that was actually ill will. But instead, to focus not on the rudeness of others, not on what they've done or left undone, but on what you have or haven't done yourself. So don't have a mind full of ill will towards others. Just focus on what you can do to change you. Okay. And then the last of these, and here's where this is where this really fits into this whole talk. The last of the unwholesome thoughts of mind is wrong view. Oh, here's view again. Wrong view is in and of itself an unwholesome state of mind. And I'm going to talk more about that. But once again, I want to read this little verse from the Dhammapada. The Buddha has kind of a sense of humor, I think, sometimes. A fool with a sense of his foolishness is, at least to that extent, wise. At least he knows he's foolish, right? But a fool who thinks himself wise really deserves to be called a fool. Because at least the guy has some sense he might have wrong view. A fool that with a sense of his foolishness is at least to that extent wise. But a fool who thinks himself wise really deserves to be called a fool. So, as I was saying a couple of minutes ago, these things are all, these 10 things aren't separate little things. They're all interrelated. One leads to another. But the interesting thing is, for instance, let's just look at this. You've done some unwholesome act of body. You've stolen something. You've acted improperly. You've killed somebody, or harmed somebody. Let's keep it simpler. Then what are you going to do? Someone's going to say, well, did you do? And you're going to go, no, not me. So now you're lying about it. So the one thing leads to another. You know, one unwholesome act leads to another unwholesome act. They're bound together in that way. Or maybe you're gossiping or even boasting about what you did and how cruel it is that you got away with it. That's, so once again, an unwholesome act of body led to unwholesome speech. As I mentioned, covetousness can often lead to, well, I really want that, so I'm going to take it. So that mental space of wanting can often lead to actually acting in unwholesome ways to get what you want. And that can be on a very small scale, or it can be, you know, like stuff, but it could also be like, I want this job, so I'm going to diss the other person I know is trying to get this job so I can get the job instead. You know, so it's like, it's very easy to fall into that sort of problem. One thing leads to another, right? ill will can arise when you sort of feel you have to protect yourself from people who say you've acted or spoken in an improper manner, or you've done something wrong and people talk about it, then your ill will arise because you feel like you have to defend yourself. You have to say, or you might say something like, well, you do that sort of stuff too. You know, that's ill will. Just coming out and pointing that finger and wagging the finger in a sense. But here's what I think is actually the interesting thing. Wrong view is the root of the other nine. All of the other nine, if you look at them to a certain extent, they all arise from having wrong view. You know, you've done or said something improper, and then you just say, well, but everybody does this. So if everybody does it, it must be okay. You know, we just had a really interesting discussion in the Sangha of teachers about how we're operating. You know, we teach these Tuesday, the every morning at 8 a.m. we have a sit, right? And we had been starting to share, you know, I would sign on as David, so we wouldn't, because it made it simpler for people to find which Zoom parameters to use. And we found out, because we were thinking of doing that on a larger scale, that this is against the license of Zoom. This is against the rules. When the Zoom license says you're not allowed to do that. And certainly my mind went right away to, well, but everybody does that. You know, and we talked to other people. In fact, we talked to another person who's sort of techie, and she was like, well, who cares? Everybody does that sort of stuff. But we actually decided not to do that anymore. It makes our life more complicated in terms of how we have people substitute for other people and that sort of stuff. But it's important, if we're doing something like that, we're teaching the Dhamma, that we do it in a totally ethical manner. So we applied right view and decided, okay, this is easier, but this is what we're going to do. Because this is what we have to do based on being honest and dealing with things. And it was just an interesting thing for me of like a real world instance of exactly what I'm talking about. Or, you know, people are rude to you or mean to you. And our mind goes to, well, it's okay if I do the same to them. They were that like that to me. I can be, you know, I'll get them back. That's wrong view. It's like we turn it into it's okay because they did it. And I'm just responding the way they responded. So in our day-to-day life, we have to be very sort of conscious of being careful about these things. And the reason all of this is so important comes right back to when we act in these unwholesome ways, the first nine on the list, when we act in those ways, it's very difficult for our mind to go still. I've harmed something, and then I feel guilty and I'm full of remorse, and you know, our mind is spinning with the whole story, and oh my God, what if I get caught? Because we get caught spinning. So this is why in many places in the sutta, the Buddha says something of the like this all starts with virtue. Everything starts with virtue. If you lead a virtuous life, you have the bliss of blamelessness. So I love that phrase, the bliss of blamelessness. But that's the truth. If we lead a virtuous life, then all those thoughts that arise from not being very virtuous sometimes, we don't have to get caught, our mind doesn't get caught spinning about worrying that we're going to get caught or feeling bad and, oh, they're not going to like me anymore, and all those things that happen when we act in improper ways, and either act or speak or even think, the covetous and ill will. So what do we do about this? Really, in some level, I'm talking about this is the nature of being a human being, right? This is like how being, we all do these things to a smaller or greater or lesser extent. This is being human. One is to be very aware of that's possibility, that you have to consciously be aware. So this is like right view in the broad sense becomes a practice. You know, we have to go, oh, does this make sense from the point of view of right view before we say or do anything, especially anything important? You know, how does it fit into this, the teachings in this way? Like that little thing I described with the licenses from Zoom, for instance. In the sutta, the Buddha says, basically, he just has this really simple phrase he uses in, all over the place. He says, basically, we have to abandon these unwholesome acts of body, speech, and mind. And abandon means, you know, I looked it up in the dictionary. I haven't got the definition with me right here, but it's something of the nature of do away with completely, you know, absolutely get rid of this stuff. Abandon it, never to return. That's part of the solution. But there's another thing, another place in another sutta, I came across this really interesting idea, and that's another way to deal with these things is to cultivate right view. To actually consciously make right view a practice that you cultivate. And in that sutta, he said there were five factors that assist right view. So here's five things we can consciously think about and practice in our lives to engender right view arising more frequently until it becomes second nature, I suppose. Here's this list, kind of an interesting list. Factors that assist right view: virtue, which I've already talked a lot about already, right? Learning, discussion, serenity, and insight. So as I mentioned, starts like many lists of the Buddha, starts with virtue. You know, and being virtuous is a practice. We have to consciously practice being virtuous. But the next one, learning. He's actually saying quite clearly here, we have to study the teachings. We can't just sort of, oh, that was interesting. We actually have to look at them and study them as a practice. You know, I've made it a very conscious part of my practice for a number of years now, like a long time, to actually have some time where I actually study, like, you know, this sutta that I came across that I've been talking about. I actually chose to study, you know, that was like, oh, I should study this sutta and see what it says. Oh, look, this will turn into a Dharma talk, I said to myself. But it's like, that's what you do. You start a new study. You look into what the Buddha actually said. And whether it's studying in my way where I read or doing what you're doing. I mean, you all right now, what you're doing is studying the Buddha's teachings. You know, coming to Dharma talks. soaking yourselves in the Buddha's teachings. It's very skillful in terms of creating a stronger sense of right view in yourself by studying the Buddha's teachings. I think that's sometimes that's what it means when we take refuge in the Dhamma. You know, taking refuge in the Dhamma means studying the Dhamma, understanding the Dhamma, you know, connecting to it in a deeper way. And it's like, then the next step, discussion. What, how did that get there, right? It's like discussion. But this is the whole idea of things like Kalyanamitta groups, you know, which are groups of spiritual friends, people who get together every couple of weeks and they have some process where they sit together for a while and then they discuss the Buddha's teachings. They all listen to a Dharma talk, you know, a recorded Dharma talk before they came to the meeting, and then they could discuss that Dharma talk, or they're progressively going through a book. I was talking to David today, you know, David has this new book out, and he says there's all these discussion groups forming around his book, which he was quite excited about. But it's like, oh, here's this interesting set of teachings. Let's study this and then discuss it. Because, you know, I read something, I study it, I get a certain point of view, some sort of understanding, but someone else will say something, and I'll go, gee, I never thought of it that way. So discussion is a very powerful way to deepen your understanding of the sutta and the Dhamma, just by meeting with like-minded people. And that's why these groups are not, there's no teacher. They're peer-led, I suppose you could call it. People, and they do them in different ways. I know there's several Kalyanamitta groups in the Boulder area, Boulder, Denver, Louisville, that Front Range, I should say, area, that where people get together on a regular basis, every couple of weeks on, you know, some night or some get together for coffee on Saturday morning, and they sit and then they talk, they share, they discuss the teachings. It's a very powerful tool to deepen your understanding because you get different flavors of understanding from different people who see things in different ways because they have different life experiences than you, among other things. So that's the third of these factors to assist right view. Then comes serenity. Serenity, huh? Calmness. It's one of the factors of awakening in this, the teachings on the seven factors of awakening. Serenity is sort of the opposite of what happens when you actually act in unwholesome ways, which cause the mind to spin and get all agitated. So serenity is like, actually, let's cultivate serenity. It also means, you know, choosing to have time when things are in your life are calm. When you're not rushing about, when you're not having to do something, when you're not just, oh, this is the space and time when I can just be still. And it might be you're being still, like when I paint, it's very serene. When I was working in my garden today, planting seeds. This is a very serene activity, just to sort of be in that still space by myself. I don't have to talk to anybody, just serenity is a very powerful way to sort of to connect to the Buddha's teachings internally. So it's something we need to find the time to actually have some serenity in our lives, to cultivate that. And then the last of these is insight. Oh, insight is like, oh, this is what arises out of practice, out of formal meditation practice. This is where insight arises. Insight here he means basically understanding, really understanding the nature of things, understanding how things really are, that everything's impermanent, you know, that there's nothing, there's no self, there's no solid self there. It's just all this flow that's going on, that nothing, everything's unsatisfactory, that there's nothing that we can depend on that's always going to make us happy. Nothing. Because, first of all, because everything's impermanent. And second, because, you know, we think that thing is solid, but it's not, it's gone. And we've depended on that for our happiness. So everything is unsatisfactory. And not knowing that on an intellectual level, insights bring us to the point where we start to know these things, where we go, that's what they were talking about. You know, where we get this sort of deeper intuitive understanding, which takes us back to the very beginning of the Eightfold Path sometimes after we've had one of those. We go, oh, now I see, now my view is clearer. Now I understand more clearly. What should my intention be now? So we go through cycles of this practice all the time, where we see deeper and we see deeper and we see deeper. So those are the factors that assist right view. So not only do we have to consciously choose not to do things, to be consciously choose the practice of virtue, but then we have to practice learning, discussion, serenity, and insight. These are things we want to cultivate in our lives because they lead to right view, becoming stronger. And remember, all these things are like progressive. It isn't like, now I got right view. I'm all set now. I've got it all figured out. It's like we see a little more, we see a little more, become a little more connected, go a little deeper all the time. So it's not like I'm in any way suggesting you should have perfect right view, that you should be perfectly virtuous, that you should be perfectly anything. You know, perfection, I saw this quoted, I love, you know, perfection is the only value of perfection is to cause you pain, cause suffering. If wanting to be perfect is a good way to make yourself suffer. So you have to understand this is all this sort of very subtle, gradual process we're going through. And the practice is like that. It isn't, well, I have to be perfect right now. It's like, can I move towards perfection a little more and a little more and a little more? And those might be the tiniest little steps sometimes. But that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to move towards perfection. It's all the process, not the end point, that's really important. So I, of course, because you all know me, I have a poem I have to read here. This is from Dana Fald's book, Going and In. I keep going back to this book and reading it and go, oh, I forgot that poem was there, which is what happened to me this time. This poem is called Let It Go. Let go of the ways you thought life would unfold, the holding of plans or dreams or expectations. Let it all go. Save your strength to swim with the tide. The choice to fight what is here before you now will only result in struggle, fear, and desperate attempts to flee from the very energy you long for. Let go. Let it all go and flow with the grace that washes through your days, whether you receive it gently or with all your quills raised to defend against invaders. Take this on faith, the mind may never find the explanations that it seeks. It's a wonderful line. Huh? Take this on faith. The mind may never find the explanations that it seeks, but you will move forward nonetheless. Let go, and the waves' crests will carry you to the unknown shores, beyond your wildest dreams or destinations. Let it all go and find the place of rest and peace and certain transformation. Pretty much clearly describes these five things that, towards right view, right? In a poetic way. So, may the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you all for joining me.